Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org. This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Harvard University is in federal court in Boston today for the first day of the trial over its admissions policies. Students for Fair Admissions alleges that Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants. WBUR's Edify reporter Carrie Young is at the courthouse. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So today was opening statements. Let's start with the attorney for the group Students for Fair Admissions. What did he say?
Well, it started out sort of with this statement of this is what this trial is about and this is what it's not about. And for them, they came out and said that this is not about affirmative action, that affirmative action is not on trial, and the benefits of affirmative action are not on trial. They are firmly focusing on the fact what they say is that Harvard is discriminating intentionally against Asian American applicants. And this opening statement, it lasted about an hour, and it really focused pretty heavily on a variety of statistical analyses to try and prove this point. First, they looked at academic qualifications of students because that is one rating that students are judged on when it comes to admissions. It showed that Asian American applicants, according to their analysis, were coming in the highest. And then another part that they focused on was that another rating, that personal score, that Asian American applicants were routinely getting lower personal scores than other ethnic groups. And personal scores they're not really based on something that's a number like a GPA or an SAT would be. It's things like personal essays, the letters of recommendation, even the amount of adversity you've faced in your life. But just to sort of break this down, I was looking at some of the plaintiffs' numbers as they were talking about them. And looking at that highest academic rating, they were saying that white students got about 29% higher. Asian American students came in at about 22%. That was below African American and Hispanic applicants as well. So they spent a lot of time just talking about these numbers and why those held up.
And you're talking about personal scores there when you say that the 29% and the 22%.
Correct.
Yes.
Talking about the personal score versus how high they achieved academically.
I see. But Harvard also spoke today. The attorney for Harvard also spoke today. Of course, disagreed with the analysis of that data. What's the main issue that Harvard takes exception with?
Well, Harvard takes exception with the idea that they are intentionally discriminating against Asian American applicants. And they say, as far as like picking apart the numbers goes, they don't like that the Students for Fair Admissions analysis removed a sector of the applications pool, and that was legacy students, athletes, Dean's List, that kind of thing. That's about 29% of the applicant pool. And they say if you actually kept that part of the applicant pool in, then you would actually see that Asian American students were actually faring much better and that there was no difference, or at least not a negative effect like the plaintiffs are alleging. So they're saying you should have kept that in. The other argument they were making was that the plaintiffs are looking at 6 years of application data altogether, when Harvard says really you should be looking at it year to year, because someone who's applying in 2014 is not competing against someone who's applying in 2016.
So how many folks for Harvard spoke?
Well, you had Harvard's attorneys, and then you also, when it comes to opening statements, you had two amici presentations sort of outlining what the testimonies would be like that are coming up when it comes to other students who are supporting Harvard. It was a group of students, and I believe there will be four of them, just talking about what this race-conscious admissions policy has enabled them to do, why it's important, and how that you can't not factor in race when it comes to lived experience. And so not considering race is kind of saying that that's not your lived experience, was the argument that they were making. But then we had another group come up and talk about how, you know, maybe there is still more work that Harvard can be doing to make things a little bit more fair, but the way to get there is not to get rid of the race-conscious admissions policy. It's to keep moving forward on their efforts and not to just say, well, this isn't working, let's just start over.
So Students for Fair Admissions here, they began the questioning. What would you say was the main focus for them throughout the day?
Right. Well, so it was just an hour's worth of questioning that they were able to get to. And the first person that they talked to was Dean Fitzsimmons. He's over admissions. And what they really focused on at the beginning was looking at this invitation that goes out to people who take the PSAT and the SAT. Basically, if you score high enough, then you get this invitation to apply to Harvard. And so they were focusing in on the fact that looking at rural states in particular, that an Asian American male had to score a 1380, I believe the number was, versus a white male had to score about 1310 to get one of those letters. And they said that that is racial discrimination. Dean Fitzsimmons' response to that was actually no. It's just that this was just a method of reaching out to people. That doesn't mean that we're discriminating when it comes to admissions. And he also was trying to explain that maybe that gets to people whose generation, who've lived in a rural state for generations, and that was sort of their way to do that.
Now, I know the arguments were wrapped up, what, 3 o'clock? So what's supposed to happen tomorrow?
We're going to be continuing with the questioning, and it will be Students for Fair Admissions who will be asking those questions for the next several days, I understand.
Okay. WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And joining us in the studio now to talk further about this case is Dan Golden. He's senior editor at ProPublica and author of the book, The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside the Gates. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So your book, which was published in 2006, was based on 2 years, right, of investigative reporting on your part. And you looked very closely at Harvard's admissions practices. And you did find that Harvard holds Asian American students to higher standards in admissions compared to other ethnic groups. Is that right? Tell us a little bit more about what you found there. Just remind people.
I did find that Asian American students, in a way, are being penalized for their excellence. And that for many years at that time, they had been just under 20% of students at Harvard, which seemed to amount to a kind of informal quota. And I compared their situation to that of Jewish students decades ago, overrepresented compared to their portion of the population, but underrepresented compared to what they should be based on their test scores and grades. And the students themselves were very conscious of it. I remember interviewing one Asian American young woman, very good test scores and grades. And when I complimented her, she said, no, that's an Asian fail. You know, I have to do better than that to get into the Ivy League because I'm Asian American. Mm. And there's very little doubt that that's the case. And the documents in this lawsuit support what I found in my book.
And also, I just want to say another thing that you brought up was, and this is actually cited by the plaintiffs in this case as well, and this are these ways that connected students could get into Harvard, these sort of hidden admissions ways that students could get into Harvard, the so-called Z-list and things like that. What was that?
That's right. I found there were several different ways that affluent white students get special treatment to Harvard. One of them is the Z-list, which is Harvard. What Harvard does is it waitlists a borderline student at a school and then waits a few months and then admits that student for the following year's class. And often this is a special program for children of alumni and donors. And that has been, again, substantiated in some of the documentation in this case. It's also turned out in this case, which I didn't know, that they have a sort of list of students of special interest to the admissions dean. And those also tend to be children of legacy of alumni and donors.
And so you would think that because you're cited here, your research is cited, that you would necessarily agree with the premise of this lawsuit.
I don't actually. I agree with part of the premise. I agree that Asian American students are being discriminated against. I'd characterize this lawsuit as right victim, wrong villain. This lawsuit attempts to use the mistreatment of Asian American applicants as justification to get rid of affirmative action, of preferences for black and Hispanic students. I think that a better solution would be to get rid of preferences for wealthy alumni children and children of donors and faculty and staff, what I called in my book the preferences of privilege. And legacies actually amount to quite a high percentage of Harvard student body, more than either blacks or Hispanics. And so I think this lawsuit is unfair in the way it plays off different minority groups against each other.
Even though we just heard from Carrie Young, our reporter at federal court in Boston, even though the argument was that, you know, the folks say this is not about affirmative action at all. This is about Harvard discriminating against Asian American students only.
They're being disingenuous. I mean, the same group that's brought this lawsuit at Harvard on behalf of Asian American students has brought other lawsuits against other universities on behalf of white students who didn't get in despite having very good records. And I've talked with the people at Students for Fair Admission, and this basically, it's not that they want to see Asian Americans be a much higher percentage of enrollment. They're using it as a cudgel because they think it's a strong weapon to get rid of affirmative action. And that's really the underlying issue in the case.
And a lot of folks have pointed to the man who's spearheading this, Edward Bloom. He's challenged affirmative action in the past. He was behind the other race-sensitive admissions policy lawsuit, Fisher versus University of Texas. You spoke with him. Is that right?
Yeah, I had a long conversation with him a couple weeks ago. And as I say, the impression I got is that his focus is on trying to get rid of race-based affirmative action. And he'll use whatever he thinks at a university is most susceptible to a challenge. At Harvard, it's the treatment of Asian American applicants. At other schools, it may be the treatment of white applicants or some other specific evidence. But it's clear to me he's not bringing this lawsuit in order to help Asian American students particularly. He wants to bring down affirmative action.
When you look at this case in particular and you look at this suit, and as we heard from Carrie, that happened in federal court today, and they talked about personal scores of Asian American students and that sort of unmeasurable quality that admissions officers can look for. And admissions officers argue we need to be able to consider that. Otherwise, we're only looking at test scores and we're only looking at grades, and there's more to a student than those kinds of things. Is there a better way for admissions officers to evaluate students in a way that could be fair and still have these unmeasurable qualities taken into account?
Well, let me answer that in a couple ways. First of all, I do think that there is a measure of stereotyping of Asian American students. And in my research from my book, you know, one admissions dean at a top university described Asian American students as something like textureless grinds or faceless grinds, and, you know, kind of implying they were all alike, which, of course, is absolutely not true. And I think there is that kind of attitude, and that's what the plaintiffs are getting at. But, of course, yes, it is very important to evaluate students not just on the basis of test scores and grades, but on their essential potential for academic achievement. And sometimes if a student doesn't go to a very good school, or if they've had illness or other challenges, their grades and their scores may not be reflective of their actual ability. And it's important to try and figure out what that potential is, not just their accomplishment, but what they could do in the right circumstances.
And also look at it big picture. What does your whole class look like? What does your community look like, right?
Well, I'm not sure how far I would go in that direction. I mean, I personally feel that universities should admit the students with the best ability and potential and record of achievement. And, you know, if that means at a university that Asian American students make up, you know, 40% of the class instead of 20%, I think that's fine.
So you think this is going to go to the Supreme Court? If not this case, then another case, because the affirmative action is going to go back before the U.S. Supreme Court. Would you say that?
I think that's quite likely. And I also feel that, you know, Harvard could lose this case, and but not necessarily with a decision that strikes down affirmative action. The courts have held in recent cases, as far as I could tell, that that universities have to exhaust race-neutral remedies, as they're called, before they use race-based affirmative action. And there doesn't seem to be much evidence of Harvard having made a serious effort to look at some race-neutral remedies, such as, for example, giving preference based on socioeconomics rather than race, or eliminating legacy preference would also be called a race-neutral example. So although it benefits whites, but it's a proxy. So I think the decision might well go along those grounds.
Hmm. Okay. Dan Golden, senior editor at ProPublica, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside the Gates. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts nurses appear to be split on the upcoming statewide ballot question that would affect their jobs. According to a new WBUR poll out today, 48% of registered nurses say they plan to vote yes on question one, which would establish nurse-to-patient ratios. 45% say they'll vote against the measure. The poll reached 500 nurses. We're going to speak with groups on both sides of what is likely the most controversial question on the ballot this fall. First, we go to Donna Kelly Williams, president of the Massachusetts Nurses Association, which supports this question. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So why do you think nurses in this WBUR poll appear to be split?
I think it's very difficult for nurses right now, especially being in the position that they are in, being intimidated and being told to vote no, and the scary tactics that are being used by the opposition. I don't think that there's any secret to the fact that nurses have been the canaries in the coal mine, actually sounding the alarm with the erosion of nursing care that we're seeing and the inability to be able to provide the care that we've been trained to provide, because nurses are being assigned too many patients at one time. Patients in the hospital are sicker.
Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, why do we need this? Why wouldn't a hospital feel the responsibility to make sure that it was adequately staffed? What are you seeing on the ground?
Boy, that's a great question, because I ask myself that all the time. Why are hospitals not hearing what we've been saying now for almost 20 years, that we're seeing less and less time for nurses to be able to provide the care that we're trained to give at the bedside? And I hear from nurses almost daily that they're being assigned too many patients. And as patients come into the hospital, they're coming in sicker than they ever were before. But when they are coming into the hospital, they're coming in because they need nursing care. If they need to see a physician, they can stop at the Minute Clinic or stop in the emergency room. But if you need nursing care, you're admitted to the hospital and you are sicker than you've ever been and you need nursing care.
You know, the Committee to Ensure Safe Patient Care, which supports question one, released a poll in April that said that 86% of nurses supported this. Well, why do you think there's this discrepancy that now we're seeing nurses split? And I think the public might look at this and say, well, how am I supposed to know? I'm not a nurse. Maybe I, you know, shouldn't participate in this at all or vote no and let collective bargaining figure this out, right?
So I am a nurse at the bedside, and I have been at the bedside for my entire career of over 40 years. The most important thing that our patients want to have is safe patient care when they're in the hospital. What's happening right now is that the opposition that does not want to have this safe patient limit put into law so that patients are cared for safely in every single hospital across Massachusetts. Doesn't matter where they are, but there would be a safe limit, not a ratio, but a limit to the number of patients that are assigned to a registered nurse at one time. In no way does that ever mean that a nurse can't help a fellow nurse who also has an assignment of four patients in the medical surgical area. What it means is that the nurse will not have more than four patients. And think about it this way, that if you're a patient in a hospital, do you want your nurse to have four patients? Or do you want your nurse to have eight patients? Mm. When you put that call light on because you're having trouble breathing or you need pain medication or you're just frightened, do you want to put that call light on and have your nurse deciding amongst eight or four?
But the same question, I mean, obviously everyone would say four, right? Everyone
absolutely.
No one would say that they want their nurse at their bedside to be overwhelmed. But I guess folks are worried about having a ballot question decide this. And with so many nurses saying no, I think people are hearing directly from nurses that they're concerned about some of the effects of this. And a lot of them have been brought up, the flexibility. What would it do in terms of flexibility and allowing the medical professionals to determine staffing for themselves? Is a ballot question the avenue to pursue this, really? Why is it?
Had to come to this. As a nurse who has been calling and sounding the alarm about this for a number of years, we've done everything that we could up to this point. When you mentioned collective bargaining, we've put this into contracts. Nurses that have been covered by collective bargaining have actually done without wages and benefit increases in order to put safe patient limits in their contract, only to have those violated by the very people that agreed to do it to begin with. We've sat on committees. We've gone to the legislature. We've done everything that we can. And in 2014, when we had a ballot initiative at that time, it ended in a compromise for the intensive care units. So there is a legal limit in the intensive care units. But right now, there is no legal limit in any other unit in the hospitals. And at that point, we said, in order for all of patients to be safe, it needs to be extended to every unit in the hospital. And we listened to the government mandate that was expressed early on, and that's why the flexibility is in this bill. It is in there with the acuity tool that allows for the adjustment, but it is a limit. There is a maximum limit.
Hmm. What about cost? Because we need to talk about cost. The Health Policy Commission released a study that said that this could increase costs by as much as $949 million a year. And some nurses that our reporter Martha Biebinger spoke with when she did the story about our poll out said that that was really influencing how they felt about this. I want to play a bit of tape here from Michael Gaudreau, who's an RN who manages two units at North Shore Medical Center, and he said why he's voting no on this. Let's listen.
If this law passes, this could be multiple $10 million impacts to our operating budget. So I'm fearful of closure of our hospital and other community hospitals.
So costs. What about costs and costs not only to hospitals and how it might affect them, but costs also to folks who say this will ultimately be passed on to insurers who will pass it on to patients in terms of premiums?
So first of all, to the hospital costs. So right now, hospitals can well afford to provide safe patient limits. The profit margin is there to be able to do this. But hospitals choose where they're going to invest their healthcare dollars. We're saying the investment has to start with the patient. The patient has to be the number one priority. And as to the concern, and this is what we have heard from nurses that are very frightened by what the opposition has put out there, hospitals make choices every single day which services are going to remain open and which they're going to close. For example, pediatrics, maternity units, mental health units, detox units. If a unit, even if it has been deemed by the Department of Public Health to be an essential service, we're seeing hospitals right now closing units that are not making money for them. So hospitals make choices, and that's the most important thing here. We're saying you can make choices as long as the patient is the number one priority for all of your healthcare dollars to be invested in.
And at this point, in terms of your nurses, I know we had a different rating in terms of unionized versus non-unionized nurses. What would you say to bring both sides together on this?
Think about the patient. The patient should be everyone's number one priority.
Okay. I want to go now to speak with someone who's on the other side of this issue. First, Donna Kelly Williams, president of the Mass Nurses Association, who supports the committee to ensure safe patient care. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Deb.
And now on the other side is Therese Hudson-Jenks, the interim CEO and senior vice president of patient care services at Tufts Medical Center. She's also a registered nurse and is voting no on question one. Hi, Therese.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Well, thanks for coming in. Tell us why you think we're seeing such a divide among nurses on question one.
I think that nurses are really giving a lot of thought to the unintended unintended consequences of this ballot question. Nurses are really worried about cutting services that they believe are important to patients. They're really concerned, knowing that 24 hospitals in Massachusetts are already in the red, that more hospitals will close. They do not want to see what happened in California happened here. They're also extremely proud of the quality outcomes we have in Massachusetts and compared to California.
And I don't want to forget. In terms of what happened in California, there are some who say that what happened in California is a reason to support this. What are you talking about when you say what happened in California is a reason, is something folks should think about and vote against this?
Well, since this ballot question has come out, we've really taken the time to study the quality outcomes in Massachusetts and compared to California. We exceed them on nearly every single CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, quality outcome indicator. We are ranked number 4 in the country through the Leapfrog Hospital Safety Grade, and California is ranked 25th. We are ranked first for America's health rankings and healthiest states, and California is ranked 17th. The list goes on and on. Most importantly, ED border times and wait times are extraordinarily long in California. And most remarkably, no improvement in quality outcomes in the past 14 years since they instituted their rigid ratio plan. That's not good enough for Massachusetts. People come from around the world to get their care here. We are doing a lot right. And as it was shown by the Health Policy Commission report last week, we already have more nurses per staffed bed than California does. We take nurse staffing very seriously. We publicly report our staffing and have done so for years. We believe that nurses matter. We believe, I'm a nurse myself, we believe that the care the nurses provide is integral to the quality outcomes. What we do not believe in is tying their hands. If a nurse wants to make a decision in the moment to care for a patient who's critically ill, we do not want some mandate telling her or him they cannot do it. Patient's status change minute to minute, and you've heard staff nurses say their own story. More and more nurses are very concerned that they're going to have their hands tied.
But what do you say to nurses like Donna Kelly Williams, president of the Mass Nurses Association, who says, you know, we need more staffing in certain areas, and we've tried to address this through collective bargaining and other issues, and we haven't been successful, and this was the last avenue that we had to pursue to make sure that patients stay safe?
Only 15% of the nurses in your poll recently believe that going to the ballot to have the voters decide is actually a good idea. And I would also say that we've added a lot of nurses. We add nurses where the patients need them, and that patients are not the same. They're not the same even on one unit every day, every minute of every day, let alone in every hospital, community hospitals compared to academic medical center. I would say to them, like, work with us to figure out exactly what patients need. And let's free the nurses so that they can make the decisions they feel are in the best interest of patients. And let's really look at quality outcomes. I would also add that I am a nurse, and I've been a nurse for 33 years. And as I already shared, nurses are integral in the quality outcomes of patient care. They're also a really important member of an entire care team. And at times, the investment we've made in other disciplines, such as pharmacists, and even for safety reasons, public safety officers, has really helped nurses do their job as well. We need to take a step back and look at really the outcomes we're trying to achieve. And we are proud of the quality outcomes in Massachusetts, and we are never going to stop making healthcare better and better for you, for me, for those we love. It's really important to all of us.
But what do you mean? I mean, this has been incredibly divisive, and as we said, probably the most controversial ballot question in Massachusetts. And there have been some charges against hospitals themselves, hospital administrators, that they're trying to pressure nurses to vote against these kinds of staffing mandates. And even in WBUR's reporting on our poll, the nurses who voted, who said they supported voting for question one, refused to give their last names or say where they worked because they were afraid of retaliation. And folks say the no on one side, your side, has spent a lot more money, more than $26 million, according to the Office of Campaign and Political Finance, on defeating this. So what do you say to those folks that this is really a question about money and the hospitals keeping the money and not making sure that there's adequate staffing and retaliating against the nurses who might support this?
Well, I'd say we need to keep our focus on what's really at stake here, and that's the healthcare system we've built in Massachusetts is extraordinary. We're concerned about ballot question number one jeopardizing that in a very significant way. As for intimidation, I was aghast when I saw for myself the social media campaign that the MNA started weeks ago on calling nurses who wanted to vote no, don't be that nurse. I can share with complete confidence that we are respectful and treat the nurses with extreme dignity. They are an incredible member of our care team. For the divisiveness, we've got to get on the same page and focus on what matters the most, and that is every single patient who needs our care, inside the hospital, outside the hospital, on the streets of Massachusetts, wherever patients are. That's a very, very serious commitment we've all made as nurses and as healthcare providers, and it's one that I and my colleagues take extremely seriously. All right. There is a lot at stake here. Massachusetts needs to get this right.
All right. Radio Boston will be devoting a full hour to this in a debate with both sides 1 week from today. But Therese Hudson-Jinks, interim CEO and Senior Vice President of Patient Care Services at Tufts Medical Center. You're also a registered nurse. Thanks very much, Therese, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. With just about 3 weeks left until Election Day, we want to check in today on the race for the 3rd District, an open seat with Democratic Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas not seeking another term. The district is diverse, and it includes communities such as Winchendon and Fitchburg, and then it goes along the New Hampshire border to include Haverhill, Methuen, and Lawrence, and then it goes south to include parts of Metro West. This week, we're going to speak with both of the major party candidates seeking this seat. Today, we're joined in studio by Pepperell businessman Republican Rick Green. Rick, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deborah. It's great to be here.
So we mentioned you're a businessman. Let's start there. You're co-founder and CEO of 1A Auto.
That's correct. My brother and I started the business almost 20 years ago in Pepperell. Literally started out of a garage. And most folks know Pepperell is a tiny town on the New Hampshire border. What they may not know is it was also a mill town. And for most of the last century, the paper mill was the largest employer in town. And in the early 2000s, when the mill fell in hard times, a lot of folks lost their job and downtown was hit pretty hard. But within a few short years, the little company my brother and I started became the largest employer in town. Today, we employ over 500 people. We have locations in Westford and Littleton as well. And when I tell folks I know what it takes to get the economic engine of the 3rd District revving, it's because I've done it.
Hmm. You also worked in the aerospace industry.
Yes.
At NASA?
Yes, for a short time, yes.
I see. So why Congress? Why a Republican?
Well, this is my way of giving back. As I said, I've just been so blessed with the success my brother and I have had with our business. And our business also is founded on empowering our customers. So one of the key things we do, we have 7,000 YouTube videos where we actually show our customers how to repair their own cars. And I think that's what Congress should be doing. We should be empowering the people to fix issues themselves. There's no issues that the people of Massachusetts can't solve.
Hmm. What do you think is the main issue you would like to deal with if you got elected? Could you give me one?
Sure. Well, I can give you a couple. Mm-hmm. But let me take it up even higher. When we first started going on the campaign trail and talking to voters, what we found is there's a disconnect. And the voters feel like they no longer understand how D.C. and the federal government impacts their daily lives. And so all the issues I talk about are bringing the government back to the people and showing the people, here's things that I can do that will impact you every day in your life. So one issue, obviously, jobs, more jobs, better jobs. And that comes from my company's experience, my economic experience. But then the other two issues to talk about, roads and bridges, our infrastructure. So many problems with our infrastructure. The Rourke Bridge in Lowell is a 35-year-old temporary bridge. And I've said I'm going to fix that. As a matter of fact, my first TV commercial, I actually jumped in the river and swam across faster than the Merrimack, faster than my brother could drive across the Rourke Bridge. And then Route 2, which goes from Concord to Gardner, you know, basically splitting the middle north-south of the district. And if you look at all the roads in Massachusetts, all the roads, the spurs that come out of Boston, they're all six-lane divided major highways, 93, 3 north-south, the Mass Pike, even 24. But Route 2 is still this old, antiquated, Depression-era highway. And you have the old Fort Devens is there, and Gardner and Fitchburg, gateway cities that need to be opened up to economic development. And then the other issue is the opioid epidemic. This is something we heard about literally from the first day on the campaign. Just it touches everyone. It doesn't care what you look like.
And Congress just passed a bill, though, to deal with the opioid epidemic.
They did, but there's still so much more going on. You know, even earlier today, we were at UTEC, which is a program for
at-risk youth in Lowell.
Yeah, it started out as at-risk youth, and they're dealing now with young adults. But the opiates touches that, and we're still not doing enough. These one-size-fits-all out of D.C., it makes the politicians feel good, but it doesn't necessarily produce the results. Mm-hmm. We really need to empower the local groups and community groups who are doing all the really good work to give them the resources. We really actually need to change the way we deliver social services entirely in this country. If you think about it, most of our social services are delivered on a Depression-era model where for every problem we have a program. But with opiates especially, you see, there's usually multiple problems. You know, any given person may need maybe a mental health issue, but there's a different program for every need they have. So there's one program for food. There's another program for health, for job training. And it's a 50-hour-a-week job just trying to keep up with the benefits. But when you have programs that they start with housing, you get the people safe, and then you bring the services to them. And I say we need to start treating people and not problems.
Hmm. So you would say for the opioid epidemic, more money and more sort of wraparound programming that would deal with a variety of issues for the folks who are suffering. That would be your main way of addressing this
Absolutely.
Issue.
I call it a surge in benefits. Hmm. So what we have now is this patchwork system where people kind of come in and out of the benefits and the services based on the given need. But they get, you know, if they've been there for 21 days and they're sober, they're pushed out. But then when they leave, it's almost another crisis moment for them where they're going back into society. They're not ready yet to cope yet. The stress is very high. Any mental health problems they have, then they go back to using. So you need to get them safe, get them housed. And if you look at the long-term costs, this surge in benefits, where you're putting people out after 12 or 18 months, you know, become productive members of society, actually lowers the cost long-term to the society.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like a Republican plan necessarily. I just want to say that, and which brings me back to a question I asked you a couple of minutes ago, and I think I'd like to just ask that again. Why a Republican and a Republican in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, I don't find the labels very helpful. I'm a Republican. I got into in politics with Scott Brown's election. I'm a businessman first. That's really what got me started with this, is my interactions with the state government at the local level sometimes weren't very positive. And you know, that's just where I fit. But again, the labels to me, it's about what you do for the people. It's about who's, you know, I look at this as a job interview. So I'm a businessman. The people of the third district are going to choose who's the best person to represent them. And my job is to show them that I can do the best job for them down in our nation's capital.
We have a Republican president right now, President Trump. You've said you voted for President Trump. What about the president's agenda? What do you think of it? And what do you think of some of the key proposals that the president wants to deal with?
Well, again, as long as it's something that's going to help the people of the third district, then I'll work with anybody, whether it's the president, Governor Baker, leadership in Congress. But for me, it all comes back. I look at everything through the prism of, will this be good for the people in my district? And if the answer is yes, then I'll be a full supporter of that agenda.
So let's talk about maybe specifically, how about a border wall? Would that be good or not good for the people in the district?
So I think the larger issue there is immigration. Mm-hmm. It's a very personal issue to me. My brother-in-law is a naturalized citizen. Actually, our second commercial is about my brother-in-law and his story, where he came to work for me, and then I invited him to Thanksgiving dinner because he didn't know anyone, and that's where he met my sister. We need more legal immigrants. Our economy is booming right now. We have jobs in my distribution center. We can't hire enough people, so we need more legal immigration. But ultimately, our country is a country of laws, and we have to all agree to abide by the rule of law. The first thing I'm going to do when I go down to D.C. is put my hand in the air and take an oath to defend the Constitution and federal laws. And I can't run a campaign on an issue like sanctuary cities and encourage local and state communities to disobey the law you know, when I'm going to take an oath to uphold it.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't agree with sanctuary cities necessarily?
No, I'm the only candidate in the race who has taken a stand against sanctuary cities.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of a border wall, what would you think about that?
Well, border security, I mean, is an absolute must. If you don't have a border, then you don't have a country.
Mm-hmm. How about guns? What do you think about reforms for guns? Should we have different types of background checks? What should we do about gun legislation?
Well, look, I mean, I'm a supporter of the Bill of Rights. So I support all the first 10 amendments, which includes the 10th Amendment, which is, you know, states' rights. And again, one size fits all coming out of D.C., to me, is usually the wrong answer. Massachusetts has our laws, and the people of Massachusetts are very happy with them. At the same time, we wouldn't want to live under the laws of, say, Wyoming or Texas. But also understand that the people of Wyoming and Texas may not want to live under our laws.
Healthcare. What should happen with Obamacare?
So, and again, I think the you're back to the labels. You know, Obamacare, it's a label. I'm not even sure what we have left, you know, is even, you know, similar to what that originally was. For me, the issues that I get asked about every day, roads and bridges, the opioid crisis, those are the issues, bringing it back to people in their daily lives. On the issue of healthcare, you look at what we have now, this patchwork, everyone talks about coverage. What's really important is the health outcomes and the quality and then the overall cost. You look at the current system, basically, you know, the middle class has, they essentially don't have health care anymore. Okay, technically they're covered, but now they have these high deductible plans. All right, so a lot of folks, the deductible is so high that folks in the middle class, even though they're covered, they can't go to the doctor. And so when I look at that, that just doesn't work. We have to figure out how to bring patient choice back into the equation. So again, I'm in automotive. If you look at the car insurance model, someone hits your car and you can go to an in-network provider, you drop it off, everything's taken care of. That's kind of like our medical insurance. But there's another choice where you could say that the adjuster comes out and says, I'll give you $1,200 for this repair and you can take it to the provider of your choice. Now, you may go somewhere else and they say, well, I don't have to fill out any administrative paperwork. I'll do that for $1,100. Or they may go online. They find my company with all of our YouTube videos. They can buy the parts for $600. They put that money in their pocket. But just that simple act of choice acts, you know, to keep a lid on pricing and to drive quality up. You look at things like eye surgery, some plastic surgeries that aren't covered by any insurance. The costs keep coming down and the quality of the outcomes keep going up.
I want to just make sure that we have enough time to ask you a few more questions here. You are the founder of the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance. Is that right?
Yes.
That's a nonprofit that advocates for fiscal responsibility in state government. And you served as the chairman of the board until earlier this year. But the group is suing the state in an effort to not disclose the organization's top five donors as required under a law in 2016. Why not disclose those donors for advertisements?
Look, I did have to step down from the group when I took my run for Congress, so I'm not involved with that lawsuit that you speak about. I heard about the same way you did. But you've mischaracterized actually what the group does. The group defends freedom of speech first and foremost, and basically that the opponents of the group say that, you know, again, that's a mischaracterization of what the group does. The group stands for freedom of speech, and nobody, specifically the government, should be able to tell people how and what they speak about.
But that line is from the mission statement on the website of the group, advocating for fiscal responsibility and state.
Well, absolutely, fiscal responsibility.
Okay. But you're saying, just make clarify for me one more time, why not disclose these donors?
Sure. So the NAACP, there was a famous case back in the 50s. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously, I believe it was the state of Alabama, could not force the NAACP to release their donors. It's very simple. You as a private citizen, I as a private citizen, we have a right to know who gives money to our elected officials, because that's very important. So we might want to know, you know, what special interests are giving them money. But the government has no right to understand who you as a private citizen give your monies to. None whatsoever. The only reason for that is intimidation. You know, the state of Alabama wanted to intimidate the people who were giving money to the NAACP, and the Supreme Court ruled unanimously the government has no right to understand what private citizens do with their own money.
But people can also influence things with their money and do it for nefarious reasons, and it's good. Transparency is good as well. So there's also that argument when it comes to money.
Transparency is government officials. okay? But private citizens is intimidation. Well, very simple.
I am sorry that we are out of time, but I'm sure we'll hear from you again. Rick Green, Republican candidate for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. On Wednesday of this week, we will be joined in studio by the Democrat in the race, Lori Trahan. Rick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We want to shift now from the House over to the Senate. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren posted a 6-minute video today, along with results from a DNA test that says she does likely have some Native American ancestry. Carlos Bustamante, a Stanford University professor, did this DNA analysis. And in the video posted by Warren today, he explains.
In the senator's genome, we did find 5 segments of Native American ancestry with very high confidence, where we believe the error rate is less than 1 in 1,000.
Now, the president likes to call my mom a liar. What do the facts say?
The facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
For more on this, we turn to WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, good to be here, Deb.
So first of all, I want to hear your thoughts on today's news from Elizabeth Warren that the DNA results showed that she most likely does have a Native American ancestor, somewhere between 6 and 10 generations back. What do you make of this?
Right. Well, I'm certainly no expert in DNA analysis, but these results come from a highly respected Stanford University genomic scientist, Carlos Bustamante, who we heard in the open there. And they seem consistent with Elizabeth Warren's longstanding claim that she does have some Native American ancestry on her mother's side. So in that video, she talks about her Oklahoma roots, that her mother's family had this Native American ancestry, and that in fact, because her father's family disapproved of that Native American ancestry, they disapproved of the marriage. And Elizabeth, so this was family lore. Then came the attacks on this claim, most recently from President Trump. Now comes this DNA test. And Bustamante concludes that the analysis suggests that Warren has a Native American ancestor in her family tree on her mother's side, dating back 6 to 10 generations. And so, Deb, that would make her as much as 1/32nd American Indian, or if the ancestor is 10 generations back, as little as 1/1,000th American Indian. Hmm.
Now, this is something Warren's been dealing with since her race against Scott Brown in 2012.
That's right.
What do you think about the timing, though, Anthony?
Well, it's all part of a carefully orchestrated effort by Elizabeth Warren to lay the groundwork for a presidential run. I mean, it's all part of a piece. She's been campaigning, raising money for other Democrats, deploying her own staffers to key primary states. She's also been putting her own tax returns online, pointing out the contrast between her and what Donald Trump has done or not done. And so I think this is part of this careful effort, in this case, to neutralize or try to neutralize one line of attack from her critics.
Mm. Now, the speculation is that Warren is doing this to clear her name, essentially. So do you think that this is enough?
Well, I mean, it really depends. I mean, look at how the birthers kept going after President Obama, even after he reluctantly released his birth certificate. But I think what this does is it gives Warren a good story to tell, a kind of inoculation maybe against her critics, or at least against folks who might have been skeptical about her claims, but who might be willing to listen. I don't think you're going to hear President Trump saying, oh, sorry, Senator, I was wrong. Sure. And in fact, let's talk about President Trump, because he made an offer to Warren at a rally over the summer in Montana. Here's what he said.
I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump, if you take the test and it shows you're an Indian, you know.
All right, so today Warren tweeted that her DNA test proves she has nothing to hide. She urged President Trump to release his tax returns. She also told him to send $1 million to a nonprofit that protects Native American women from violence.
So after Senator Warren releases this video today and these DNA tests, I'm assuming the president was asked about this. What was his response?
Right. He was asked, and here's a bit of an exchange with reporters as he was about to board a helicopter in Washington.
No, I have no. Who cares?
The
said you paid $1 million to charity.
I didn't say that. I didn't. You better read it again.
So he says, "Who cares?" And he said, "What about that $1 million offer?" He said, "I didn't say that." Well, we know, in fact, he did say that.
So he spoke also, Anthony, with Warren's opponent in the Senate race, Jeff Deal. What did he say about this?
Right. He responded to the news once again, calling on Elizabeth Warren to drop out of the race. Deal says the DNA test is just the latest evidence that Warren is no longer interested in being a senator. Here's a bit of what he said.
What she's doing now is just trying to make national news in a way that, again, highlights the fact that she really wants to run for the presidency.
Now, that's sort of no secret that she wants to run for the presidency. She has said that after the November election, she's going to take a hard look at a White House bid. And as we've mentioned, she's already done a lot to lay the groundwork for that. So
all right.
There we are.
So we'll be talking about this some more, I'm sure. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks so much for your time today.
The story that never goes away.
Never goes away.
My pleasure, Deb.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Beck. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.